gave him what he asked for. Winder's troops advanced, the skirmishers recoiling before them, and took up a new position behind a snake-rail fence. Here they were even worse exposed to the shells that tore along their line. Wavering, they began to leak men to the rear. A gap appeared. Rapidly it widened. Soon the brigade was in full retreat. Past Winder, past Jackson, past whatever tried to stand in their way or slow them down. It was a rout worse than Kernstown. But fortune's smile was steady. The men of Ewell's brigade, arriving on the left, soon after Taylor's men filed off to the right, replaced Winder's and blocked a Federal advance. As they did so, a terrific clatter erupted at the far end of the line. It was Taylor. He had come up through a tangle of laurel and rhododendron. Three charges he made against double-shotted guns, and the third charge took them, though the cannoneers fought hard to the last, swinging rammer staffs against bayoneted rifles. Then, as the Union commander attempted a left wheel, intending to bring his whole force against Taylor, Ewell's 3rd Brigade arrived in time to go forward with the 2nd. Outnumbered 3-1, fighting now with both flanks in the air and their strongest battery turned against them, the Federals fell back, firing erratically as they went. For the Confederates, it was as if all the pieces of a gigantic jigsaw puzzle had fallen suddenly into place of their own accord. Eyes aglow, Stonewall touched Ewell's arm and pointed. "He who does not see the hand of God in this is blind, sir. Blind." It was now 11 o'clock. A good 8 hours of daylight remained for pursuit. Pursue was easier said than done, however. Tyler's men withdrew in good order, covering the retreat with their 10 remaining guns. Jackson had to content himself with gleaning 800 muskets from the field while the cavalry pressed the retreating column, picking up prisoners as they went. Soon the ambulances were at work. When all the wounded Confederates had been gathered, the aid men gave their attention to the Federals. However, this show of mercy was interrupted by Fremont. Free at last to maneuver, he put his guns in position on the heights across the river, and, now that the battle was over, began to shell the field. Jackson, much incensed, ordered the ambulances back. Federal casualties for the day were 1,018, most of them inflicted during the retreat, including 558 prisoners. Stonewall's were in excess of 800, the heaviest he had suffered. The battle was over, and with it the campaign. Jackson put his army in motion for Brown's Gap before sundown, following the prisoners and the train which had been sent ahead that morning. By daylight he was astride the gap high up the Blue Ridge, well protected against attack from either direction, and within a day's march of the railroad leading down to Richmond, which the past month's fighting in the valley had done so much to save. He intended to observe Shields and Fremont from here, but that turned out to be impossible. Lincoln ordered them withdrawn that same day. Fremont was glad to go. He had expended his troops' last effort in reaching Port Republic, he reported. But not Shields, who said flatly, "I never obeyed an order with such reluctance." Jackson came down off the mountain, sent his cavalry ahead to pick up 200 sick and 200 rifles Fremont abandoned at Harrisonburg, and recrossed South River, making camp between that stream and Middle River. There was time now for rest as well as for looking back on what had been accomplished. "God has been our shield, and to his name be all the glory," he wrote his wife. Not that he had not cooperated. To one of his officers he confided that there were two rules to be applied in securing the fruits which the Lord's favor made available. "Always mystify, mislead, and surprise the enemy, if possible. And when you strike and overcome him, never let up in the pursuit so long as your men have strength to follow. For an army routed, if hotly pursued, becomes panic-stricken, and can then be destroyed by half their number. The other rule is, never fight against heavy odds if by any possible maneuvering you can hurl your own force on only a part, and that the weakest part, of your enemy, and crush it. Such tactics will win every time, and a small army may thus destroy a large one in detail, and repeated victory will make it invincible. Application of these strategic principles, plus, of course, the blessing of Providence, particularly in the form of such meteorological phenomena as cloudbursts and hailstones large as hen eggs, had enabled Stonewall, with 17,000 troops, to frustrate the plans of 60,000 Federals whose generals were assigned the exclusive task of accomplishing his destruction. 4 pitched battles he had fought, 6 formal skirmishes, and any number of minor actions. All had been victories, and in all but one of the battles he had outnumbered the enemy in the field anywhere from 2 to 17 to 1. The exception was Cross Keys, where his opponent showed so little fight that there was afterwards debate as to whether it should be called a battle or a skirmish. Mostly this had been done by rapid marching. Since March 22nd, the eve of Kernstown, his troops had covered 646 miles of road in 48 marching days. The rewards had been enormous. 3,500 prisoners, 10,000 badly needed muskets, 9 rifled guns, and quartermaster stores of incalculable value. All these were things he could hold and look at, so to speak. An even larger reward was the knowledge that he had played on the hopes and fears of Lincoln with such effect that 38,000 men, doubtless a first relay soon to have been followed by others, were kept from joining McClellan in front of Richmond. Instead, the greater part of them were shunted out to the valley, where, fulfilling their commander's prediction, they gained nothing and lost much. Beyond these tangibles and intangibles lay a further gain, difficult to assess, which in time might prove to be the most valuable of all. This was the campaign's effect on morale, North and South. Federals and Confederates were about equally fagged when the fighting was over, but there was more to the story than that. There was such a thing as a tradition of victory. There was also such a thing as a tradition of defeat. One provoked an inner elation, esprit de corps, the other an inner weariness. Banks, Fremont, and Shields had all three had their commands broken up in varying degrees, and the effect in some cases was long-lasting. The troops Stonewall had defeated at McDowell were known thereafter by friend and foe as Milroy's Weary Boys, and he had planted in the breasts of Blenker's Germans the seeds of a later disaster. Conversely, repeated victory, as Jackson phrased it, had begun to give his own men the feeling of invincibility. Coming as it did after a long period of discouragement and retreat, it gave a fierceness to their pride in themselves and in their general. He marched their legs off, drove them to and past exhaustion, and showed nothing but contempt for the man who staggered. When they reached the field of battle, spitting cotton and stumbling with fatigue, he flung them into the uproar without pausing to count his losses until he had used up every chance for gain. When it was over and they had won, he gave the credit to God. All they got in return for their sweat and blood was victory. It was enough. Their affection for him, based mainly on amusement at his milder eccentricities, ripened quickly into something that very closely resembled love. Wherever he rode now, he was cheered. "Let's make him take his hat off," they would say when they saw him coming. Hungry as they often were, dependent on whatever game they could catch to supplement their rations, they always had the time and energy to cheer him. Hearing a hullabaloo on the far side of camp, they laughed and said to one another, "It's old Jack, or a rabbit." 3. Confederate authorities at the seat of government did what they could to keep the news of Johnston's wound and the subsequent change of commanders out of the papers. Enterprising newsboys sometimes wandered out beyond the fortifications, profitably hawking their journals in the Union camps, and the authorities feared that the enemy might find comfort and encouragement in the news. They were right. "I prefer Lee to Johnston," McClellan declared when he heard of the shift, meaning that he preferred him as an opponent. "The former is too cautious and weak under grave responsibility. Personally brave and energetic to a fault, he yet is wanting in moral firmness when pressed by heavy responsibility, and is likely to be timid and irresolute in action. He wrote this under the influence of a new surge of confidence and elation. At the time of Fair Oaks, in addition to the depression he felt at hearing that McDowell was being withheld, he had been confined to bed with neuralgia and a recurrent attack of malaria, contracted long ago in Mexico, but he was feeling much better now. Pride in the reports of his army's conduct in that battle, so fierce that 8 out of the 9 general officers in Keyes's corps had been wounded or had had their horses shot from under them, restored his health and sent his spirits soaring, as was shown in the congratulatory address he issued a few days later. "Soldiers of the Army of the Potomac," it began, "I have fulfilled at least a part of my promise to you. You are now face to face with the rebels who are held at bay in front of their capital. The final and decisive battle is at hand. Unless you belie your past history, the result cannot be for a moment doubtful. Soldiers," it ended, "I will be with you in this battle and share its dangers with you. Our confidence in each other is now founded on the past. Let us strike a blow which is to restore peace and union to this distracted land. Upon your valor, discipline, and mutual confidence, the result depends." The men enjoyed the sound of this, the reference to their valor and the notion that the war was being fought for peace. Some of them had wondered. Now they knew. It was being fought to get back home. That knowledge was a gain, and there were others. Having done well in one big battle, they felt they would do better in the next one. They could laugh now at things that had seemed by no means humorous at the time. For instance, the boy going up to the firing line with the fixed stare of a sleepwalker, pale as moonlight, moaning, "O Lord, dear good Lord," over and over as he went. They had a familiarity with the mechanics of death in battle. Coming up the peninsula, they had passed a rebel graveyard with a sign tacked over the gate. "Come along, Yank. There's room outside to bury you." Since then, many of them had served on burial details, fulfilling the implication, and undertakers were doing a rush business with both the quick and the dead, embalming the latter and accepting advance payments from the former, in return for a guarantee of salvation from a nameless grave in this slough they called the Chicken Hominy. The going price was $20 for a private and up to $100 for an officer, depending on his rank. Their main consolation was McClellan. He gave the whole thing meaning and lent a glitter to the drabness of their camps. They cheered him as he rode among them. They took their note of confidence from him. Presently, after fretful news from the Shenandoah Valley, they saw his confidence increase. He had just been informed that Lincoln had called off the goose chase after Jackson and was bringing McDowell back to Fredericksburg, with orders to resume the advance on Richmond as soon as his men recovered from their exertions. Best of all, as a cause for immediate rejoicing, the 9,500-man division of Brigadier General George A. McCall, left on the Rappahannock while the rest of the First Corps was crossing the Blue Ridge, had been ordered to join McClellan at once, moving by water to assure the greatest speed. Their transports began to arrive at White House June 11th, 5 days after the march order was issued. As these reinforcements came ashore, a dispatch arrived from Stanton. "Be assured, General, that there has never been a moment when my desire has been otherwise than to aid you with my whole heart, mind, and strength since the hour we first met. You have never had and never can have anyone more truly your friend or more anxious to support you." Next day, Army headquarters moved to the south bank of the Chickahominy, where 3 of the 5 corps now were. Keyes on the left at White Oak Swamp, Heintzelman covering the Williamsburg Road in the center, and Sumner on the right astride the railroad. Porter and Franklin were still on the north bank, the former advanced to Mechanicsville, the latter in support. When McCall arrived, he would be assigned to Porter, whose strength would be 27,500 men, and Franklin would join the main body, taking position between Sumner and the river. The army then would present an unbroken front, anchored firmly on the left and extending a strong right arm to meet McDowell, who had wired on June 8th. McCall goes in advance by water. I will be with you in 10 days with the remainder by land from Fredericksburg. McClellan had plenty to do while he waited. The rains had returned with a vengeance, taking the bridges out again, flooding the bottoms and sweeping away the corduroy approaches. The whole face of the country is a perfect bog, he informed Washington. The men are working night and day up to their waists in water. Lincoln and Stanton kept wanting to know when he would be ready to attack, and he kept stalling them off with a series of loopholed replies. A week after Fair Oaks, he told them, I shall be in perfect readiness to move forward and take Richmond the moment McCall reaches here and the ground will admit the passage of artillery. 6 days later, with McCall on hand and 4 corps consolidated south of the Chickahominy, he declared, I shall attack as soon as the weather and the ground will permit. June 18th, the rain slacked, and he wired, After tomorrow we shall fight the rebel army as soon as Providence will permit. It was a tantalizing progression of near commitments and evasions. First McCall, then the weather, and finally Providence itself. Lincoln and Stanton scarcely knew what to think. McClellan knew, though. He had read rumors that the powers in Washington were engaged in a frenzy of backbiting over the recent fiasco in the valley. Alas, poor country that should have such leaders, he groaned, adding, When I see such insane folly behind me, I feel that the final salvation of the country demands the utmost prudence on my part, and that I must not run the slightest risk of disaster, for if anything happened to this army, our cause would be lost. He saw his way to victory. According to the Pinkertons, the rebels had the advantage of numbers, but he had the advantage of superior training and equipment. Therefore, he would make the contest a siege. Employing the utmost prudence to avoid the slightest risk, he had evolved a formula for victory, ponderous but sure. He kept it from Lincoln and Stanton, who would neither approve nor understand, but he told it gladly to his wife, who would do both. I will push them in upon Richmond and behind their works. Then I will bring up my heavy guns, shell the city, and carry it by assault. Whether Lee was cautious, weak, wanting in moral firmness, timid and irresolute, remained to be seen, but part at least of McClellan's judgment of his opponent had already been confirmed. He was energetic, and Southern soldiers agreed with the Northern commander that it was to a fault. Reverting to his former role as King of Spades, he had them digging as they had never dug before. Their reaction was the one he had encountered in the Carolinas, that entrenchments were cowardly affairs and that shoveling dirt wasn't fit work for a white man. Lee's reply was that hard work was the very means by which McClellan has been and is advancing. Why should we leave to him the whole advantage of labor? There is nothing so military as labor, and nothing so important to an army as to save the lives of its soldiers. A third complaint, that digging would never drive the Yankees away from the gates of Richmond, he left for time to answer. Meanwhile, there were those who, remembering his earnest statement back in May, Richmond must not be given up, it shall not be given up, considered that he might be saving his soldiers' lives for a quite different purpose, entirely aside from the sheer humanity of the thing. He saw the problem posed for him by his fellow engineer. McClellan will make this a battle of posts. He will take position from position under cover of his heavy guns, and we cannot get at him. What Lee needed in the face of this was time, and he got it. The first 10 days of June were solid rain. You have seen nothing like the roads on the Chickie Bottom, he reported thankfully. McClellan's big guns were immobilized unless he brought them forward on the York River Railroad, and Lee moved quickly to block this route by mounting a long-range 32-pounder on a railway truck and running it eastward to outrange the swamp-bound federal ordnance. This was the birth of the railroad gun, fathered by necessity and Lee. The men could appreciate this kind of thing, its benefit being immediately apparent. They could appreciate, too, the new administrative efficiency which brought them better rations and an equitable distribution of the clothes and shoes it prized from quartermaster warehouses. There was a rapid improvement of their appearance and, in consequence, their tone. Lee himself was frequently among them, riding the lines to inspect the progress of their work on the entrenchments. Tall, handsome, robust, much younger looking up close than from a distance, he had a cheerful dignity and could praise them without seeming to court their favor. They began to look forward to his visits and even take pride in the shovel work they had performed so unwillingly up to now. The change for the better was there for everyone to see, including their old commander, convalescent in Richmond. "No, sir," Johnston said manfully when a friend remarked that his wound was a calamity for the South. "The shot that struck me down is the very best that has been fired for the Southern cause yet. For I possess in no degree the confidence of our government, and now they have in my place one who does possess it, and who can accomplish what I never could have done, the concentration of our armies for the defense of the capital of the Confederacy." This, in fact, was a main key to Lee's success in the course of his first weeks as head of the army in Virginia. He knew how to get along with Davis. Unlike Johnston, who had kept his intentions from the president as assiduously as if the two had been engaged as opponents in high-stakes poker, Lee sought his advice and kept him informed from day to day, even from hour to hour. One of the first letters he sent from the field was to Davis, describing certain administrative difficulties in one of the commands. "I thought you ought to know it," he wrote. "Our position requires that you should know everything, and you must excuse my troubling you." Davis fairly basked in the unfamiliar warmth, and gave, as always, loyalty for loyalty received. Knowing him well, Lee knew that this support would never be revoked. Whatever lay before him down the months and years, he knew that he would never have to look back over his shoulder as he went. Nor would he, like his opponent, have to step cautiously in anticipation of a fall from having the rug jerked from under him by wires leading back to his capital. What lay before him now was McClellan, whose battle of posts would begin as soon as the weather turned Union and dried the roads. Such a battle could have only one outcome, the odds being what they were. As Lee saw it, he had but two choices: to retreat, abandoning Richmond, or to strike before his opponent got rolling. The former course had possibilities. He could fall back to the mountains, he said, "and if my soldiers will stand by me, I will fight those people for years to come." However, it was the latter course he chose. At first he considered a repetition of Johnston's tactics, an attack on the federal left, but he soon rejected the notion of making a frontal assault against an entrenched and superior enemy who, even if defeated, could retreat in safety down the peninsula, much as Johnston had retreated up it. The flank beyond the Chickahominy was weaker and more exposed to attack, and once it was crushed or brushed aside, the way would be open for seizure of McClellan's base at White House. Cut off from his food and munitions, the Union commander would be obliged to come out of his entrenchments and fight the Confederates on ground of their choice, astride his lines of supply and communication. When Lee submitted the plan for presidential approval, Davis raised a question. If McClellan behaved like an engineer, giving all his concern to his line of supply, the thing might work. But what if he assaulted the weakened line in front of Richmond while Lee was mounting the flank attack, with troops stripped from the capital defenses? Would that not mean the fall of the city? Lee bridled at the reference to engineers, his own branch of the service as well as McClellan's, but said that he did not believe his opponent would attempt such a desperate venture. Besides, that was why he had put the men to digging, to enable a thin line to withstand an assault by superior numbers. It would not have to be for long. If you will hold as long as you can at the entrenchments and then fall back on the detached works around the city, I will be on the enemy's heels before he gets here." So he said, and Davis, after consideration, agreed that the long odds required long chances. He approved the plan of attack. The first problem, once the plan had been approved, was the securing of reinforcements. No matter how ingenious the tactics, 61,000 Confederates could not hope to drive more than 100,000 Federals from a position they had been strengthening ever since their repulse of the full-scale assault 2 weeks before. As a problem, it was thorny. South Carolina could spare no men at all, Charleston being menaced by an amphibious force assembling at Hilton Head. But Burnside seemed to be resting on his New Bern laurels, so that the rest of Holmes's division could be brought from North Carolina, adding 6,500 bayonets to the ranks. Georgia could furnish a single brigade. Lee sent it to Jackson. "We must aid a gallant man if we perish," he said, having already weakened his army for this purpose. Besides, it was in the nature of a loan. Stonewall was to use the troops offensively if the opportunity arose, discouraging the Washington authorities from sending reinforcements to the peninsula from the valley or the line of the Rappahannock. Then, when everything was ready for the leap at McClellan, he was to leave his cavalry and his least effective infantry units in their present location and take the cars for Richmond, adding 18,500 veterans to the column of assault. This would bring Lee's total strength to 86,000, still about 20,000 short of McClellan's. Total strengths were not as important, however, as critical strengths at the point of vital contact, and that was where Lee proposed to secure the advantage. He would hold the Richmond entrenchments with the combined commands of Magruder, Huger, and Holmes, while those of Longstreet, the Two Hills, and Jackson struck the isolated enemy corps on the north bank of the Chickahominy. In round figures, 30,000 men would be facing 75,000 to the east, while 55,000 assaulted 30,000 to the north. Or, more roughly speaking, one-third of Lee's army would resist three-fourths of McClellan's, while the remaining two-thirds attacked the remaining one-fourth. The risk was great, as Davis said, but not so great as the possibilities for gain. As the Federal main body, its right wing crushed, fell back to recover or protect its seized or threatened base, the Confederates would catch it in motion and destroy it, flank and rear. Richmond would be delivered. No matter how devoutly this consummation was to be wished, a great deal remained to be done before it could begin to be accomplished. Jackson's approach march from the railroad would be along the ridge between the Chickahominy River and Totopotomy Creek, an affluent of the Pamunkey. Lee knew that McClellan had withdrawn Porter's troops from Hanover Courthouse soon after the junction with McDowell was suspended, but he did not know the present location of Porter's right or the condition of the roads in that direction. Both of these necessary pieces of information could be gathered, along with possibly much else, by a reconnaissance in force. That meant cavalry, and cavalry meant Jeb Stuart. Accordingly, on June 10th, Lee sent for him and told him what he wanted. Stuart was delighted. A brigadier at 29, square-built, of average height, with china-blue eyes, a bushy cinnamon beard, and flamboyant clothes, thigh-high boots, yellow sash, elbow-length gauntlets, red-lined cape, soft hat with the brim pinned up on one side by a gold star supporting a foot-long ostrich plume. He had had no chance for individual distinction since the charge that scattered the fire Zouaves at Manassas. He had a thirst for such exploits, both for his own sake and his troopers, whose training he was conducting in accordance with a credo. "If we oppose force to force, we cannot win, for their resources are greater than ours. We must substitute esprit for numbers. Therefore I strive to inculcate in my men the spirit of the chase." That partly explained the gaudy fox hunt clothes, and it also explained what he proposed as soon as Lee had finished speaking. Once he was in McClellan's rear, he said, it might be practicable to ride all the way around him. Lee might have expected something of the sort, for Stuart had been an industrious collector of demerits as an adventurous cadet at the Point, while his fellow Virginian was superintendent. At any rate, in the written instructions sent next day while Jeb was happily selecting and assembling 1,200 troopers for the ride, the army commander warned him explicitly against rashness. "You will return as soon as the object of your expedition is accomplished, and you must bear constantly in mind, while endeavoring to execute the general purpose of your mission, not to hazard unnecessarily your command or to attempt what your judgment may not approve, but be content to accomplish all the good you can without feeling it necessary to obtain all that might be desired." These were sobering words, but Stuart was pleased to note that the general called the proposed affair an expedition, not merely a scout or a raid. At 2 a.m. on the 12th, he passed the word to his unit commanders standing by. "Gentlemen, in 10 minutes every man must be in the saddle." Within that time they set out, riding north out of Richmond as if bound for the Shenandoah Valley. Only Stuart, who rode at the head of the column, knew their true destination. His high spirits were heightened by the knowledge that his opposite number, commanding McClellan's cavalry, was Brigadier General Philip St. George Cook, his wife's father, an old-line soldier who, to his son-in-law's discomfort and chagrin, had stayed with the old flag. "He will regret it but once," Jeb said, "and that will be continuously." The 3-day wait following Stuart's disappearance into the darkness was a time of strain for Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia. For one thing, the weather turned Union. The roads were drying fast under the influence of a hot spell. For another, there was information that McClellan was receiving reinforcements. McCall's division had come up the York in transports, adding its strength to the preponderance of numbers already enjoyed by the Blue Army in front of Richmond. Taken together, these two factors indicated that the Battle of Posts was about to begin before Lee could put his own plan into execution. The strain was not considerably relieved by the arrival of a courier late on the 14th, with the first news from Stuart since he left. Far in the Federal rear, after wrecking a wagon train and capturing more than 300 men and horses, he had decided that it would be safer to continue on his way instead of turning back to cut a path through the disrupted forces gathering in his rear. Accordingly, he had pushed on eastward, then veered south to complete his circuit of the enemy army. But when he reached the Chickahominy, 30-odd miles below the capital, he found the bridges out and the water too swift and deep for fording. That had been his plight when the courier left him. A swollen river to his front and swarms of hornet-mad Federal horsemen converging on his rear. However, he was confident he would get out all right, he said, if Lee would only make a diversion on the Charles City Road to distract the Bluecoats while he continued his search for an escape route. Lee was not given to swearing, or else he would have done so now. At any rate, the day was too far gone for the diversion Stuart requested. And next morning, before the order could be issued, Jeb himself came jingling up to headquarters. His fine clothes were bedraggled, and the face above the cinnamon beard showed the effects of 2 nights in the saddle without sleep. But he was jubilant over his exploit, which he knew was about to be hailed and bewailed in southern and northern papers. Improvising a bridge, he had crossed the Chickahominy with his entire command, guns and all, then ridden up the north bank of the James to report to Lee in person, at a cost of one man lost in a skirmish 2 days back. He had brought out 170 prisoners, along with 300 horses and mules, and added considerably to whatever regret his father-in-law had been feeling up to now. Beyond all this, he had also brought out the information Lee had sent him after. McClellan's base was still at White House, and there was no indication that he intended to change it. The roads behind the Federal lines, which the enemy would have to use in bringing his big guns forward, were in even worse shape than those in the Confederate front. And finally, Porter's right did not extend to the ridge between the Chickahominy and Totopotomy Creek. In fact, that whole flank was practically in the air, open to Jackson's turning movement along the ridge. The moment was at hand. After feeling out the enemy lines that afternoon to determine whether Stuart's ride around McClellan had alarmed the northern commander into weakening his front in order to reinforce his flank beyond the river, it had not. Lee wrote to Jackson next morning, June 16th. 5 days ago, congratulating Stonewall for the crowning double victory at Cross Keys and Port Republic, he had sent him a warning order, alerting him for the march toward Richmond. Now the instructions to move were made explicit, though in language that was courteous to the point of being deferential. The present seems to be favorable for a junction of your army with this. If you agree with me, the sooner you can make arrangements to do so, the better. In moving your troops, you can let it be understood that it was to pursue the enemy in your front. Dispose those to hold the valley so as to deceive the enemy, keeping your cavalry well in their front, and at the proper time suddenly descending upon the Pamunkey. I should like to have the advantage of your views and to be able to confer with you. We'll meet you at some point on your approach to the Chickahominy. With the date of the attack dependent on Jackson's rate of march, there was little for the southern commander to do now except wait, perfecting the details of the north bank convergence, and hope that his opponent would remain astride the river with his right flank in the air. The strain of waiting was relieved by good news of a battle fought in South Carolina on the day Lee summoned Stonewall from the valley. The Federals had mounted their offensive against Charleston, landing 6,500 troops on James Island, but were met and repulsed at Secessionville by Shanks Evans, with less than half as many men, inflicting 683 casualties at a cost of 204. Evans increased the reputation he had won above the stone bridge at Manassas and on the wooded plateau above Ball's Bluff, and was proclaimed the savior of Charleston. Though this minor action scarcely balanced the recent loss of Fort Pillow and Memphis, or the evacuation of Cumberland Gap 2 days later, it made a welcome addition to the little string of victories won along the twin forks of the Shenandoah River. Lee was encouraged to hope that the tide was turning, at least in the east, and that the blue host in front of Richmond might soon be caught in the undertow and swept away or drowned. Our enemy is quietly working within his lines and collecting additional forces to drive us from our capital, he wrote in a private letter June 22nd, 3 weeks after taking command. I hope we shall be able yet to disappoint him and drive him back to his own country. Next afternoon, the possibility of such a deliverance was considerably enhanced by the arrival of a dusty horseman who came riding out the 9 mile road to Army headquarters. It was Jackson, stiff from 14 hours in the saddle, having covered 52 miles of road on relays of commandeered horses. He presently was closeted with Lee and the other 3 division commanders, who would share with him the work of destruction across the river. Lee spread a crude map and explained the plan as he had worked it out. Stonewall, coming down from the north with Stuart's troopers guarding his left, was to clear the head of Beaver Dam Creek, outflanking Porter and forcing him to evacuate his main line of resistance, dug in along the east bank of the stream. That way, there would be no fighting until after the enemy had been flushed from his entrenchments, and by then the other 3 attack divisions would be on hand, having crossed the Chickahominy as soon as they learned that Jackson was within range. The crossing was to be accomplished in sequence. A.P. Hill would post a brigade at Half Sink, 4 miles upstream from his position at Meadow Bridge. Informed of Jackson's approach, this brigade would cross to the left bank and move down it, driving Porter's outposts eastward until they uncovered Meadow Bridge, which Hill would cross to advance on Mechanicsville. This in turn would uncover the Turnpike Bridge, permitting a crossing by D.H. Hill and Longstreet at that point and in that order. The former would move past his namesake's rear and swing wide around Beaver Dam Creek in support of Jackson. The latter would form on A.P. Hill's right for the advance through Porter's abandoned entrenchments. All four commands would then be in line, in echelon, from left to right, Jackson, D.H. Hill, A.P. Hill, and Longstreet, for the sweep down the left bank of the Chickahominy. Once they cleared New Bridge, 4 miles below Mechanicsville, they would be in touch with Magruder and Huger, who would have been maneuvering Prince John style all this time to discourage an attack on their thin line by the Federal main body in their front. With contact reestablished between the two Confederate wings, the danger of such an attack would have passed. As Lee said, they would be on the enemy's heels in case he tried it. The advance beyond the river would continue, slashing McClellan's communications and coming between him and his base of supplies at White House. There were objections. Harvey Hill had expressed the opinion that an attack on the Federal left would be more rewarding. McClellan might respond to the assault on his right by changing his base to the James, beyond reach of the attackers. Lee had pointed out, however, that this would involve the army in the bogs of White Oak Swamp and rob it of the mobility which was its principal asset. Besides, Stuart's reconnaissance had shown that the Union base was still at White House, and Lee did not believe the Federals would attempt to make the shift while under attack. Longstreet, too, had indicated what he thought were disadvantages, the main one being the great natural strength of Porter's position along Beaver Dam Creek. However, this objection would be nullified by Jackson, whose approach would maneuver Porter out of his entrenchments by menacing his rear, and if he fell back to another creek bank stronghold, there were several such in his rear, at more or less regular intervals along the north bank of the Chickahominy, the same tactics could be applied with the same result. Thus were Hill and Longstreet answered. Stonewall made no comment, being a stranger to the scene, and A.P. Hill, the junior officer present, held his tongue. After the brief discussion, Lee retired to give the quartet of generals a chance to talk his plan over among themselves. They were young men, all four of them, though they disguised the fact with beards. Longstreet was the oldest, 41, A.P. Hill the youngest, 37. D.H. Hill was 40, Jackson 38. They had been at West Point together 20 years ago. Longstreet spoke first, asking Jackson to set the date for the attack, since his was the only command not on the scene. The 25th, Jackson replied without hesitation. Longstreet demurred, advising him to take an extra day to allow for poor roads and possible enemy interference. All right, Jackson said, the 26th. Presently, Lee returned and approved their decision. Today was Monday. The attack would be made on Thursday at the earliest possible hour. He would send them written orders tomorrow. The council broke up about nightfall. Jackson had spent most of the previous night in the saddle, but he would take no rest until he rejoined his men on the march. Mounting, he rode through the darkness, accompanied as before by a single aide, whom he had instructed to call him Colonel, as a precaution against being recognized before he got his army into position to come booming down along McClellan's flank. While Stonewall clattered north along unfamiliar roads to rejoin the valley soldiers moving to meet him, McClellan sat alone in his tent, winding up a long day's work by writing to his wife. For various reasons, some definite, some vague, but all disturbing, he felt uneasy. Intelligence reports showed that his army was badly outnumbered, and Stuart's circumferential raid had not only afforded hostile journalists much amusement at the young Napoleon's expense, it had also emphasized the danger to his extended flank and to his main supply base, both of which lay on the far side of what he still called the confounded Chickahominy. He had protested, for McDowell's sake as well as his own, against the instructions requiring that general's overland advance and an extension of my right wing to meet him. Such dispositions, he warned Stanton, may involve serious hazard to my flank and line of communications, and may not suffice to rescue him from any peril in which a strong movement of the enemy may involve him. Nothing having come of this, he was obliged to keep Porter where he was. The danger to his base was another matter, one in which he could act on his own, and that was what he did. On the day Stuart returned to his lines and reported to Lee, McClellan ordered a reconnaissance toward James River, intending to look into the possibility of establishing a new base in that direction. 3 days later, June 18th, he began sending transports loaded with food and ammunition from White House down the Pamunkey and the York, up the James to Harrison's Landing. Gunboats, stationed there to protect them, would also protect his army in case it was thrown back as a result of an overwhelming assault on its present all-too-vulnerable position astride the Chickahominy. Meanwhile, he continued to reconnoiter southward, sending cavalry and topographical engineers beyond White Oak Swamp to study the largely unknown country through which the army would have to pass in order to reach the James. He had the satisfaction of knowing that he was doing what he could to meet such threats as he could see. However, there were others, vague but real, invisible but felt, against which he could take no action, since all he could feel was their presence, not their shape. He felt them tonight, writing the last lines of the bedtime letter to his wife. "I have a kind of presentiment that tomorrow will bring forth something. What? I do not know. We will see when the time arrives." What tomorrow brought was a rebel deserter who gave his captors information confirming McClellan's presentiment of possible disaster. Picked up by federal scouts near Hanover Courthouse, the man identified himself as one of Jackson's Valley soldiers. "Stonewall now had 3 divisions," he said, "and was moving rapidly south and east for an all-out attack on the Union flank and rear. It would come," he added, "on June 28th, 4 days away. McClellan alerted Porter and passed the news along to the War Department, asking for the most exact information you have as to the position and movements of Jackson." Stanton replied next day, June 25th, that Jackson's army, with an estimated strength of 40,000, was variously reported at Gordonsville, at Port Republic, at Harrisonburg, and at Luray. He might be moving to join Lee in front of Richmond. Other reports had him marching on Washington or Baltimore. Any one of them might be true. All of them might be false. At any rate, the secretary concluded, the deserter's information could not safely be disregarded. McClellan scarcely knew what to believe, though as always he was ready to believe the worst, in which case only the stump of a fuse remained before the explosion. He opened at once with all his artillery north and south of the river and sent Heintzelman's corps out the Williamsburg Road to readjust its picket lines and test the enemy's strength in that direction. The result was a confused and savage fight, the first in a sequence to be known as the 7 Days. He lost 626 men and inflicted 541 casualties on Huger, whose troops finally halted the advance and convinced the attackers that the front had not been weakened in that direction. McClellan's spirits rose with the sound of firing. He shucked off his coat and climbed a tree for a better view of the fighting, but declined again as the firing died away. Though his line south of the river was now within 4 miles of the enemy capital, he could not clear his mind of the picture of imminent ruin on the opposite flank, drawn by the deserter the day before. Returning to headquarters at sundown, he wired Stanton, "I incline to think that Jackson will attack my right and rear. The rebel force is stated at 200,000. I regret my great inferiority in numbers, but feel that I am in no way responsible for it, as I have not failed to represent repeatedly the necessity of reinforcements, that this was the decisive point, and that all the available means of the government should be concentrated here. I will do all that a general can do with the splendid army I have the honor to command, and if it is destroyed by overwhelming numbers, can at least die with it and share its fate. but if the result of the action which will probably occur tomorrow or within a short time is a disaster, the responsibility cannot be thrown on my shoulders. It must rest where it belongs. Riding toward the sound of heaviest firing, Lee had arrived in time to see Yuji's men stop Heintzelman's assault before it reached their main line of resistance. The attack had been savage, however, and it had the look of at least the beginning of a major push. A fine rain was falling, the first in a week, but not hard enough to affect the roads, which had dried out considerably during the hot spell. McClellan might be starting his battle of posts, advancing his infantry to cover the arrival of his siege guns, or he might have attacked to beat Lee to the punch, having learned somehow that the line to his front had been weakened to mount the offensive against his flank. In either case, the safest thing for the Confederates to do was call off the North Bank assault and concentrate here for a last-ditch defense of the capital. These things were in Lee's mind as he rode back through the camps where the men of Longstreet and D.H. Hill were cooking 3 days' rations, in preparation for their march to get in position under cover of darkness for the attack across the Chickahominy next morning. He weighed the odds and made his decision, confirming the opinion one of his officers had given lately in answer to doubts expressed by another as to the new commander's capacity for boldness. His name might be Audacity. He will take more desperate chances, and take them quicker than any other general in this country, north or south, and you will live to see it, too. The plan would stand. The Richmond lines would be stripped. McClellan's flank would be assaulted, whatever the risk. And as Lee rode to his headquarters, people drawn to the Capitol Hills by the rumble of guns looked out and saw what they took to be an omen. The sun broke through the mist and smoke, and a rainbow arched across the vault, broad and clear above the camps of their defenders. It held, and then it faded. They went home. Presently, for those in the northeast suburbs unable to sleep despite the assurance of the spectral omen, there came a muffled sound as if something enormous was moving on padded feet in the pre-dawn darkness. Hill and Longstreet were in motion, leaving their campfires burning brightly behind them as they marched up the Mechanicsville Turnpike and filed into masked positions, where they crouched for the leap across the river as soon as the other hills' advance uncovered the bridges to their front. By sunup, Lee himself had occupied an observation post on the crest of the low ridge overlooking the Chickahominy. The day was clear and pleasant, giving a promise of heat and a good view of the Federal outposts on the opposite bank. The bluecoats took their ease on the porches and in the yards of the houses that made up the crossroads hamlet. Others lolled about their newly dug gun emplacements and under the trees that dotted the landscape. They seemed unworried, but Lee was not. He had received unwelcome news from Jackson, whose foot cavalry was 3 hours behind schedule as a result of encountering poor roads and hostile opposition. This last increased the cumulative evidence that McClellan suspected the combination Lee had designed for his destruction. At any moment, the uproar of the Union assault feared by Davis might break out along the four-mile line where Magruder, his men spread thin, was attempting to repeat the theatrical performance he had staged with such success at Yorktown back in April. By 8 o'clock, all the units were in position along the near bank of the river, awaiting the sound of Stonewall's guns or a courier informing them that he, too, was in position. But there was only silence from that direction. A.P. Hill sent a message to the brigade posted upstream at Half Sink. "Wait for Jackson's notification before you move unless I send you other orders." Time wore on. 9 o'clock. 10 o'clock. The three-hour margin was used up, and still the only word from Jackson was a note written an hour ago informing the commander of Hill's detached brigade that the head of his column was crossing the Virginia Central, 6 hours behind schedule. President Davis came riding out and joined the commanding general at his post of observation. Their staffs sat talking, comparing watches. 11 o'clock. Lee might have remembered Cheat Mountain 9 months ago in West Virginia, where he had attempted a similar complex convergence once before with similar results. High noon. The six-hour margin was used up, and still no sound of gunfire from the north. 1 o'clock. 2 o'clock. 3 o'clock. Where was Jackson? McClellan knew the answer to that. His scouts had confirmed his suspicions and kept him informed of Stonewall's whereabouts. But he had another question. Why didn't he come on? After the dramatic and bad-tempered telegram sent at sundown of the day before, he had ridden across the river to check on Porter's dispositions, and finding them judicious, one division posted behind Beaver Dam Creek, the other two thrown forward, had returned in better spirits, despite a touch of neuralgia. Every possible precaution is being taken, he informed the authorities in Washington before turning in for the night. If I had another good division, I could laugh at Jackson. Nothing but overwhelming forces can defeat us. This morning he had returned for another look, and once more he had come back reassured. Now, however, as the long hours wore away in silence and the sun climbed up the sky, apprehension began to alternate with hope. At noon he wired Stanton, "All things very quiet on this bank of the Chickahominy. I would prefer more noise." 4. If noise was what he wanted, he was about to get it, in full measure, from a man who had plenty of reasons, personal as well as temperamental, for wanting to give it to him. Before the war, A.P. Hill had sued for the hand of Ellen Marcy. The girl was willing, apparently, but her father, a regular Army career officer, disapproved. Hill's assets were $10,000, a Virginia background, and a commission as a Coast Survey lieutenant. And Colonel Marcy aimed a good deal higher for his daughter than that. Ellen obeyed her father, whose judgment was rewarded shortly thereafter, when George McClellan, already a railroad president at 33, with an annual income amounting to more than the rejected lieutenant's total holdings, made a similar suit and was accepted, thereby assuring the daughter's freedom from possible future want and the father's position within a year as chief of staff to the commander of the Army of the Potomac. Hill, meanwhile, had gone his way and married the beautiful sister of John Hunt Morgan of Kentucky, red-haired like himself, and so devoted to her husband that it sometimes required a direct order from the commander of the Army of Northern Virginia to remove her from the lines when a battle was impending. Hill then had in fact more cause to feel gratitude than resentment toward the enemy chief of staff and commander for rejecting and supplanting him. However, he was a hard fighter with a high-strung intensity and a great fondness for the offensive. So that in time McClellan's soldiers, familiar with the history of the tandem courtships, became convinced that the Virginian's combativeness was a highly personal matter, provoked by a burning determination to square a grudge. Once, at least, as Hill's graybacks came swarming over the landscape at them, giving that high-throated fiendish yell, one of McClellan's veterans, who had been through this sort of thing before, shook his head fervently and groaned in disgust. "God's sake, Nellie, why didn't you marry him?" A narrow-chested man of average height, thin-faced and pale, with flowing hair, a chiseled nose and cheekbones jutting high above the auburn bush of beard, Hill had a quick, impulsive manner and a taste that ran to the picturesque in clothes. Today, for instance, as always when fighting was scheduled, he wore a red-wool deer hunter's shirt, his battle shirt, he called it, and his men, knowing the sign, would pass the word, "Little Powell's got on his battle shirt." More and more, however, as the long hours wore away in front of Meadow Bridge, they began to think he had put it on for nothing. The detached brigade had crossed at Half Sink soon after 10 o'clock, when Jackson sent word that he had reached the railroad. Since then, nothing had been heard from that direction. 5 hours had passed, and barely that many still remained of daylight. Hill chafed and fretted until he could take no more. At 3 o'clock, Rather than hazard the failure of the whole plan by longer deferring it, as he subsequently reported, I determined to cross at once. From his post on the heights overlooking the river, Lee heard a sudden popping of musketry from upstream. As it swelled to a clatter, he saw bluecoats trickling eastward from a screen of woods to the northwest, followed presently by the gray line of skirmishers who had flushed them. Then came the main body in heavy columns, their bayonets and regimental colors glinting and gleaming silver and scarlet in the sunlight. The Yankees were falling back on Mechanicsville, where tiny figures on horseback gestured theatrically with sabers, forming a line of battle. East of the village, the darker foliage along Beaver Dam Creek began to leak smoke as the Union artillery took up the challenge. Far to the north, directly on Jackson's expected line of advance, another smoke cloud rose in answer. Stonewall's guns were booming. As Little Powell's men swept eastward, the troops of D.H. Hill and Longstreet advanced from their masked positions along the turnpike and prepared to cross the Chickahominy in support. Late as it was, past four now, with the sun already halfway down the sky, the plan was working. All the jigsaw pieces were being jockeyed into their assigned positions to form Lee's pattern of destruction for the invaders of Virginia. As usual, there were delays. The Turnpike Bridge had to be repaired before Harvey Hill and Longstreet could go to the assistance of A.P. Hill, who was fighting alone on the north bank, prodding the makeshift Yankee line back through Mechanicsville. Lee sent him word not to press too close to the guns massed along Beaver Dam Creek until support arrived and Jackson had had time to outflank the fortified position. While the repairmen were still at work on the bridge, a cavalcade of civilians